Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. More than 20 organizations across the state, including a few here in Northwest Indiana, have received the funding to be able to bring scholars into their towns and cities to help Hoosiers understand and talk about urban, suburban, and rural differences and connections. It's all part of the Inseparable initiative that is underway with Indiana Humanities, and we have with us from our office in Indianapolis, Program Director Megan Telligman. Hey, Megan, thanks for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And explain, if you will, first what the Inseparable initiative is all about and why it's a good opportunity for folks that have questions, have maybe learned something about it. We'll get to hear from some interesting speakers in the months ahead.
Yeah, so at Indiana Humanities, our main goal is to get Hoosiers to rethink and talk. And we do this in a variety of ways. We work in two-year thematic initiatives, so all of our programs and some of our grant-making right now all have to do with what's oft referred to as the urban-rural divide. And so we wanted to encourage Hoosiers to kind of think deeply and talk about what the media tells us about why we're divided and also imagine what unites us across our differences. So we kind of put a call out for scholars throughout the state to kind of give us their perspective on urban, rural, and suburban dynamics. And we came up with this great group of 20 scholars that are going to travel all over in the next 2 years and kind of talk at libraries and schools about these important issues.
Wow. Now, I know that we have, as we mentioned in the beginning of our conversation, a number of the libraries and other organizations here in Northwest Indiana that are going to participate. Lake County Library, for example, mm-hmm. Crown Point Community Library. Down in Jasper County, an organization in Rensselaer is going to be able to participate in this as well. Tell us more about the number of speakers that you have that have set up for the Speakers Bureau, which is, I know, one of your projects that you work on, along mm-hmm. with others at the Indiana Humanities. What, in turn, will they be able to talk about? What kind of topics are they going to bring to in their speeches when they come visit the locations this year?
Yeah, absolutely. So we kind of have all of the talks. There are 20 talks in the Bureau. We'll probably add more next year. But they're divided in categories such as literature and art, food and drink, demographics and mapping, land and environment, media and representation. So there are a lot of different ways in which the scholars are bringing their expertise to these talks. In particular, the ones that are happening up in Northwest Indiana include Adele Fraser University professors Allison Sheedy and Liz Werfel, who have spent years in Lake County and Porter County collecting oral histories about Gary's deindustrialization and the white flight. So they're members of the Speakers Bureau, and they'll be traveling to Maryville and Crown Point to give talks on what they've learned over the years. Down in Rensselaer, we'll have Amanda Egan, who's going to talk a little bit about media representation, so how social media does or doesn't reflect the reality of how we interact with each other face-to-face. So she's going to provide some perspective on that and open up conversations about, you know, is Facebook the best way for us to talk to each other? What is or isn't representative in those kind of online interactions?
I understand that the overall goal of the Inseparable project is to basically to get people to kind of think out of and move out of their box, and especially if they're tied up in the urban, suburban, rural divide that's been set up in all over Indiana, but in particular we have here in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, that's kind of the push behind this and why we called it Inseparable, right? One, we like a pun, so anything with IN in the title is going to be good for us. But we also want people to think about, yes, you know, the media, social media, all of these narratives are telling us we're so divided. What would it take to be inseparable? And where might we find connections with the people we live with in this state if we only engaged and had more face-to-face interactions and conversations?
I know that the Speakers Bureau, of which you're a big part of, and what's planned for the months and the weeks ahead, is just part of the overall initiative. What has already been established since the Inseparable initiative got started just a few months ago?
Yeah, so one of the major components of this is we're working with the Smithsonian Institution and their Museum on Main Street program to bring a traveling exhibit to Indiana called Crossroads, Change in Rural America. So this highly professional Smithsonian exhibit is traveling to six sites in Indiana with fewer than 15,000 people living in the city. Mm-hmm. So people will be able to kind of have this opportunity to reflect on the major changes that have happened in rural America, you know, including population loss, immigration, all of those kind of ways in which rural America has really changed since the kind of idealized time that we have in our minds.
I know that we've focused particularly on Northwest Indiana, but there are a lot of other libraries and other opportunities across the state for people to, and apparently not even just going beyond the Speakers Bureau, but checking this this traveling exhibit out here. Tell us about some of the other places in the state, rural places in particular, that will probably benefit the most from this opportunity.
Yeah, and we've just gotten some great new partnerships in working with the exhibit. So it'll be in southern Indiana in New Harmony and Jonesboro, and also in Salem and Jennings County. So I encourage people to take a road trip this summer. The closest to Northwest Indiana is actually in Bristol for the Elkhart County Historical Museum. Mm-hmm. So like I said, it's a very engaging Smithsonian exhibit, so it's worth taking the road trip this fall or next year to see it.
Now, is there a way for folks that if they want to find out what is going to be happening as far as the Speakers Bureau locally is concerned, where they can see who's coming in and at what dates and then try and make some of these conversations?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have an online event calendar on our website that lists all of our upcoming programs by region. So you can visit indianahumanities.org/calendar to find that information.
What kind of reaction have you gotten so far there at Indiana Humanities from around the state and from Northwest Indiana in particular, if you have, on the setup of the Inseparables initiative so far?
Yeah, absolutely. So we held our first kind of statewide event, which is called Chew on This. It's a statewide dinner party, and we did that a few months back. And the conversation, we started with the basics of this theme, which is what divides us. And we think that there's a real thirst for this kind of conversation in the state. People feel more divided and more polarized than ever on whatever axis you want to describe that polarization. So the dinner party, like this kind of statewide conversation that we held, I think people are thirsty for connecting with people and talking through this kind of narrative that we're being fed and trying to talk to people different than themselves or about how to cross boundaries or engage with and accept difference. And so far in the first few months of this theme, we see people ready and willing to engage and try to envision a future where they have more connections to their neighbors.
Have you gotten some comments back as to people saying, well, why didn't you think of this sooner? what's kept you so long in getting this out there? But I guess some of this is it just happens in time. There's a progression, I guess, that maybe we have to go through. Maybe we have to see how this urban-rural dynamic plays out. We hear about a lot of course, financially in the business world and economics, but we don't always get it from the humanities point of view, do we?
Yeah, we think the humanities can really provide lenses so we understand where the history of these divides come from, but also the humanities are the perfect place for gray area, right, where there's not necessarily the perfect right answer, but it actually opens us up for discussion and conversation about things that are difficult for us to talk about.
Now, Megan, if you will, give us the website address again, and especially if people want to go on to the Speakers Bureau listing and find out which speakers are coming to what areas in Northwest Indiana they'd like to check out the conversations.
Yeah, so it is indianahumanities.org. And for a full list of Inseparable programs, you can click on Inseparable on the homepage, or you can go to indianahumanities.org/inseparable.
Wow. Megan Taligman is a program manager for Indiana Humanities, and she's helping set up the Speakers Bureau that is going to be in operation very soon with more than 20 organizations around the state and about a half a dozen of them here in Northwest Indiana that have gotten the funding to be able to bring the scholars into their communities and help continue on the conversation on how urban, suburban, and rural differences and connections can be brought together and maybe even breached if necessary to make some changes. Just happened. Megan, thank you very much for being with us to talk about it today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Teacher pay and school funding were central issues for the policymakers as they put together Indiana's spending plan earlier this year. But the unpredictable structure of funding support in the state can be challenging for schools. And about one-third of Indiana's school districts have had to ask local communities for more funding through voter-approved tax hikes, known as referendum measures. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay tells us, that support is very vital for school districts that are facing some big financial cuts.
The steel mills of northern Indiana inspired the River Forest Community School's mascot, the Ingots.
I wish I would have brought my Ingot shirt today.
And as high school senior Julian Wilson talks with a couple of his classmates, a clear theme emerges, school pride.
And being in this school has really made me feel that Ingot spirit, and I really wanted to just share that with people and really give them my point of view.
He's talking about the funding referendum voters recently passed for the district. He's one of a handful of students who spoke with local taxpayers to get more of them to say yes, and they did. Superintendent Steve Disney says without those dollars, a lot was at stake.
Teaching positions, the staff positions, to looking at transportation for extracurriculars.
River Forest and the rest of Lake County schools are gearing up for a financial challenge most public schools in Indiana have faced for nearly a decade, property tax caps. When the caps went into place, lawmakers gave Lake and St. Joseph counties a decade to adapt. So starting next year, Disney says River Forest will be cut off from collecting about another $600,000 in local funding.
What that means at River Forest, that increase of $600,000 loss would have amounted to our entire transportation program.
And there aren't enough state dollars coming in. Two main factors determine most state support: student enrollment and number of students in poverty. So some schools could see little or no increases, while others lose money. Combined with limits on property taxes, that leaves many public schools scrambling for cash.
We have become, I'm very honest to say, we have become a referendum state.
Denny Costerson, executive director of the Indiana Association of School Business Officials, says past funding changes mean some schools already have more money than others.
There are discrepancies in this state. There's some equity issues, meaning that some districts, because of whatever circumstances in the past, are in a better situation fiscally than others are.
Some districts rely on voters to pass referenda often, but not all communities can or want to. Franklin Community Schools, just outside of Indianapolis, proposed a referendum for the first time this year. The district built a new high school around the time tax caps started. Chief Financial Officer Jeff Mercer says voters would have probably rejected a referendum then.
There was a lot of consternation about the building of the high school. So for us, 10 years ago, doing a referendum was not an option.
Mercer says the district has lost out on more than $27 million in local funding with the caps in place, and state support isn't enough. He says the recently passed referendum will help close growing gaps for things like teacher pay between districts.
We had a teacher take a $21,000 pay increase to do the same job in a different district. That's a problem.
Because keeping teachers in class means stability for kids.
You know, we can all survive on less or more money, and if you don't like what you make, you can go somewhere else and survive it. Those kids have no choice. That's where they're at.
Lawmakers will study school funding this summer to figure out how best to target dollars to the most in-need schools, and they plan to study the effects of school referenda on teacher pay. In the meantime, schools have to rely on their communities to keep classrooms open or have fewer of them. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Coming up later this month, involving the Urban League of Northwest Indiana and also the Indiana Plan, is a very special opportunity for folks who would like to learn more about the construction trades, what they can learn about not only the trades themselves, but how they can get involved and maybe even find an opportunity for work sometime. A free construction trade seminar is planned for Wednesday, June 19th in Gary. And to tell us more about it, Roman Bronson, who represents the Indiana Plan, is with us. And Mr. Bronson, thanks for being with us here on the program today.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure speaking.
Many people may or may not be aware of what the Indiana Plan is all about. Take a few minutes and tell us a little bit more about how the Indiana Plan got started, what the mission of the plan is, and how in particular it helps to take care of issues about workforce development here in Indiana.
The Indiana Plan started statewide back in 1970, actually. It was the result of an executive order by President Lyndon Johnson that was supposed to address the lack of representation of certain populations within the union building trades. And it came to our area in particular, the Northwest Indiana area, back in the 1990s, early 90s. So since then, as an organization, we've facilitated many opportunities for minorities, women, et cetera, to gain exposure to union construction, how to get involved, as well as work with some of the signatory contractors with these various unions, working with the Northwest Indiana Building Trades Council to facilitate some on-the-job training opportunities for individuals. So really proud of their work. I've been doing this for about the last 2 years. I'm with Electricians Local Union 697, and our mission to increase participation in underrepresented populations is always an ongoing endeavor. And that's why we decided to try to get ahead of some of this construction that's going to be coming up in our area, as far as Gary, Hammond, East Chicago, et cetera, and get people knowledge as far as how to get involved, what are apprenticeships, what are benefits, and make sure that everybody has an opportunity at least to gain access to these organizations and also gain access to a better future with some living wages and benefit if they find that it's a good fit for them.
Now, we talk in this particular case here about a pre-apprenticeship program, but many people aren't necessarily aware of how many apprenticeship programs for all of the trades are out there still. We know that things have changed over the years, and we are sure that people probably think, oh, there are no apprenticeship programs out there, but that's not the case, is it?
No, it's not, actually. That's a great point. Thank you for bringing that up. Most of the time when people think about apprenticeships, if they're even knowledgeable about it, they think carpenters, electricians, plumbers. But there's 20 different trades represented in Northwest Indiana. Some of those that I like to highlight sometimes, and I'm sure other people haven't heard about, say, technical engineers, sheet metal workers, boil makers, pipe fitters. The list goes on and on. And all of these are different organizations with similar living wages and benefits that sometimes people say, okay, well, maybe this particular part of construction isn't of interest to them. But that's what we do with the Indiana Plan. We also visit a lot of these different facilities, and they give us some hands-on opportunities for the people that's in the program to start seeing, like, oh, okay, maybe I'm not interested in electrical, but I am interested in, say, roofing. And all the different aspects of roofing, whether it's not just what's on in a residential project as far as what's on top of your house, but they also delve into some green technologies. They call them living roofs, where they implement plants, et cetera, to be the top of the roof. Now you're starting to get into some eco-friendly building.
And you're also talking, too, about a program here in this case that is evolving, I guess, even as it goes on. And it just shows how the trades have had to evolve, too, from what they were back in the 20th century going into the new technology of today, right?
Exactly. Whether it's with the plumbers, they're starting to get into GPS-guided construction methods, or if it's with electricians with the photovoltaic that is sun panels, et cetera, or whether it's you with the pipe fitters, and now they have to start getting into more eco-friendly materials that they have to fabricate for these different industrial partners. like you said, it's always an evolving field. It has to catch up with everybody else.
The construction trade seminar that is coming up on June 19th, that's going to be held at the Urban League of Northwest Indiana building, which is on Broadway in Gary, is an opportunity, I guess, for anybody that wants to take advantage of the learning process to learn more, not only about, I guess, jobs, but about careers. I know that's what you talk about in particular. And there's a definite education process that goes about this here. How is, within the Indiana plan, does the educational process seem to work?
The education component is, most people don't realize that exactly, you use the exact right term, it's a career. And starting your career, there's an educational portion. And for the apprenticeships, it's more just what are your aptitudes as far as your math, your reading comprehension. A lot of the trades have to go meet customers, and just like every other field, it's starting to become some international people that you have to be able to communicate with in an effective manner. So there's also how do you present yourself, your vocabulary, all these things. With the Indiana plan, we have a two-week program where we go over a lot of these different subjects to get someone to a point where they can be attractive to an organization. Like you said, there's still some antiquated thoughts as far as what makes a good construction person, and that's why a lot of individuals are not having success getting into an apprenticeship. They have a very highly selective rate. I would say probably some of them can be around 10% individuals that apply to actually get in. And what that is, they're weeding out it's this very specific mix of someone that is intelligent, industrious, articulate, but also willing to go in and do some of that dirty work. Trying to provide not just the education portion of it as far as getting people up to speed with their math and reading, et cetera, but we also try to introduce some understanding of what the job site culture will be like and how to be successful in the midst of it.
How long has the Indiana plan been really concerned about the problem of low minority participation in the building trades these days?
Very concerned, very concerned. Myself, I'm from Gary, Indiana, lived there pretty much my whole life. I'm also African-American. And when I was coming through school, so there's a very personal stake in it for me. When I was coming through school, I wasn't aware of the opportunity that I could have with the construction trades, with the union construction trades. So once I became involved with the electricians local, and it's really been a transformative opportunity for me and my family, I'm very concerned about making sure everybody at least have the knowledge. There's more than one route to being successful after you graduate high school. So that is a top of my priority. And as the building trades as a whole on an international level, there are resolutions coming down from the top that states that we need more everybody on these job sites. And and they've chosen to use the Indiana plan as one of those conduits to get that message out.
Now, we mentioned that the free trade construction trade seminar is coming up on Wednesday, June 19th. It's going to happen at the Urban League of Northwest Indiana building, which is at 3101 Broadway in Gary. You're encouraging pre-registration. How can people that are interested in attending the seminar be able to pre-register?
Just if you could send us an email for anybody that's interested, first come, first basis. And our email is ipgary@indianaplan.org. Or you can call our office at 219-884-4503. Again, that's 219-884-4503. There is limited space, so we encourage everybody to pre-register.
Well, Roman, thank you for the information, and it's nice to know more about the Indiana plan. It's been long running here in the Hoosier State in helping people learn more about the apprenticeship programs that get involved in the construction trades in particular. That's what this free construction trade seminar coming up on June 19th is all about. Thank you for being with us to talk about it today. Roman Bronson represents the Indiana plan. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and back in studio with us is Northwest Indiana activist Ruth Needleman. Ruth, thanks for joining us once again.
It's always a pleasure to come here and chat.
We got,
I must say.
Got quite a few things on the list there. Let's jump right in and talk about the issues.
I actually want to start with a recommendation.
Okay.
You know, summer, a lot of people spend some time at home. They want a good something to watch. This is not easy to watch. Ava DuVernay, who is a fabulous film director-producer, has just done a movie when they see us, which is based on the frame up of the five young boys, ages 14 to 15, for the Central Park rape years ago. And I have to say, when I watched part one, I thought I was going to have to turn it off. It's very painful. But this is so important to understand how police get admissions from people who are innocent. Plus, these are little kids. And so this film not only shows what they go through, what happened that night, and how they get framed, it then shows the trial, and then you see the grown-ups who have lost their childhood and most of their lives. And what I think is so important is that there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of families who have gone through traumas like this. When your child, when your husband, when your wife, when your daughter get pulled in by police who are unethical, who need to close a case quickly, they do truly brutal and horrible things sometimes. I mean, that's what happened in Chicago with the police chief, and this is New York. But a lot of people look at that as, well, this is my life and it's horrible. And they don't understand that these kinds of actions impact the way you see the world, the way you live in the world, and how you respond to everyday things. And it's called a trauma response. Your brain becomes wired to be fearful, to hide, to be isolated, which is why we have set up in the city of Gary something called Can We Talk, which is a community-based program for healing from trauma by building community. There's no magic bullet. I'm a trauma survivor, and I carry it my whole life. But when you share your story, when you get support, when you understand how your brain, how you react to something in the present as if it were the past. And so I wanted to let people know that this program is relaunching at a new location, Can We Talk? We're going to start the last Monday in August. And we provide a free meal, free daycare, and we have music, poetry, and things that will help bring us together to help us heal collectively from whether the trauma is racism or incarceration or death in the family or domestic violence. Whatever has happened to you impacts you, and it doesn't go away on its own. And so if you're interested in this, you can check out our Facebook page, which is called the Hope Center in Gary, and we will be posting information. You can also text me at my cell phone number, which is 219-743-5489, because we're going to start by having an open meeting. We're pretty sure the evening of July 16th. It's a Tuesday at 6 o'clock, and we're going to have some people there who will talk about how to talk about trauma. Because most people will say, that's just my life, or there's nothing you can do about it, or because the fear associated with, people don't want to talk about it. But talking helps. And so we want to invite everyone to check our Facebook page. I will be posting things. If you're interested in getting involved at any level, helping us serve dinner, helping to maybe you play a musical instrument and you want to share your feelings through art or music or dance or poetry, we would love to include you. So that's the first thing.
Okay.
Second thing, I went to our forum on Saturday at the Glenn Theater with our state representatives Vernon Smith, Earl Harris Jr., and Reagan Hatcher. And I have to say, we're lucky to have such strong people who can deal with a horrible reactionary, I don't know what to call them, but our state legislature is one of the worst in the country. They look for how to go back to the work, to the past at its worst. So, for example, every year we get new abortion restrictions and we get cuts with teachers. It was so important this year, and people were pushing for a raise for teachers, and they didn't get it. And they gave more money to private schools, religious schools, and charter schools than to public schools. This is unspeakable. Public education is really the touchstone of a democracy, and we are losing it throughout the state, but especially in Gary. We are down to one high school, and there has been talk about consolidating everything onto one campus. Community schools is what builds community, so you can trust your kids get to school safely. They can play after school because the students live in the same neighborhood. You can share childcare or babysitting with parents you meet at the PTA. That's why we have community schools. And so that was a real slap in the face that the legislature did the opposite of what people wanted. The other thing they talked about was the fact that we did not get an anti-hate crime bill. We are still one of the few states in the country, and the reason we didn't get it is because they refused to name some of the worst forms of hatred, which is against transgendered and against gay and lesbian. And also, they wouldn't even name gender or sex, you know, not even against women. That's not a hate crime bill. It leaves it up to the judge to decide whether something is a hate crime. So they will be working very hard in the year to come to try and muster up more support for a real hate crime bill. The one big victory was the casino bill, which our Senator Eddie Melton pushed with all his heart to allow for the moving of the casino off of the lakeshore onto I-94 so that there can be development that creates more jobs on the lakefront and also a larger casino more conveniently located off of I-94. I might just mention that our senator, who is a gem, Senator Eddie Melton, has made a little announcement saying he's looking to see whether he will run for governor.
Yeah, he's established this exploratory committee.
That's right. I've already wrote and told him that was the best news I've heard since Trump got elected, although it's still not good news. The other thing I asked about was obviously our airport that does the deportations for Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, and Kentucky. This time, all of them said this is not good for our community. That's the first time that people recognized that doing the deportations hurts the airport's development, because who wants to develop around an airport that gets known for doing major deportations at a time when it is linked to family separation? And when we know that the people who are deported have committed a civil offense, but not a criminal offense, driving without a license, just being here and going to check in on their status can get them deported. Now, what's interesting is the situation is changing in Illinois, because the new mayor, what's her name? I knew it would go.
Lori Lightfoot.
Yes, Lori Lightfoot. She is not so happy with the situation with the deportations going out of the Chicago Gary Airport. She also has been confronting ICE with some of the horrible treatment of families and especially children. And so there could be movement there. Plus, Illinois passed a law saying there shall be no private detention centers or prisons in the state of Illinois. And there's still an RFP out there because they need a prison to maintain the high level of deportations. That means they're coming back to Gary. So Northwest Indiana Resist hasn't been out to the airport recently because it's very frustrating. When we go, the deportations move to O'Hare. When we don't go, the deportations happen in Gary. But we have a plan coming up. First of all, we're going to do a float in the Mexican Independence Day Parade. And if you like fun things, we need your help because we're going to have what we're calling the Solidarity Float. Mm-hmm. And we're going to put not only Jose Morelos, the father of the Mexican Revolution, but Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass on that float. Because when Mexico got its independence, they opened its border to fugitive slaves, creating the largest underground railroad in the country. Most people do not know the history of Solidarity. And so that's what our float will speak to. We need puppet makers. We need designers. We need all kinds of help. We need your newspapers, your chicken wire. And you can get in touch with us through Facebook, or we have a website called nwiresist.com. And if that all fails, you can text me at my cell phone number. So we're really looking to meet with people and change the conversation in Gary around this.
Okay. One last thing we want to get to today, Ruth, is something that you mentioned that needs to be explained because it may be something that the city of Gary, the Common Council, is going to have to take up. It's something which is entitled a Community Benefits Agreement. Tell us what that is and how important it is really to the city of Gary.
It is so important, and actually we think we have Roman Bronson on board. Mm-hmm. A community benefits agreement says that development within a city has to benefit more than just the developer. You know, very often somebody builds something, they make a fortune, they hire people who don't live in the city, and so no money comes back to the city. And so a community benefits agreement looks at a few things. It says hire locally. And if people aren't ready for the job, put money aside for training. And of course, that's what Roman is talking about. We want to train people, especially people who live in what are called disparaged zip code zones. Mm-hmm. The poorest areas of East Chicago, of Gary, of Hammond, of the whole region. These are the people that really need jobs because when they get jobs, they spend it on food and housing and clothing, and they spend it all in their communities. So the idea is this development in and of itself a benefit to the community? So, for example, do we need another trucking center? Or would it be better if we had low-cost housing? Do we need a senior center? Or do we want high-priced condos that nobody who lives here can afford? So it's the nature of the project. It's the employment for the project and the set-aside of money for training so that the community does better when construction happens.
Is there a move by the Common Council in Gary to introduce this in the form of an ordinance or something?
It's actually we've been fighting for it for almost 10 years now.
Oh.
And at one point we did get support from the mayor and the city council, but they have a local hiring ordinance. They claim it doesn't mean anything unless it's Gary money. And of course, Gary doesn't have money. But you can write it into a contract and make it an essential recognized part and not say local hiring if practicable, because that means it's not going to happen. And so when it's put into the contract, which is why it's so important to work with the trades, then people in the community benefit, people who live here benefit, and also the jobs create wealth in the community.
Well, Ruth, that's good to hear, and we hope that that maybe some action will come out of Gary Common Council
before
too long.
There are meetings going on.
Good.
And soon it will be public.
Wonderful. Ruth Edelman's a Northwest Indiana activist with us here in the studio to talk about some of the issues, especially ones coming up in the weeks and the months ahead. And as always, Ruth, thanks for coming by today.
My pleasure. Just remember, if you're not active, you can't have a better society, and we all deserve a better society.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Lake County recycling officials had to close one of its newest drop-off centers in Crown Point because of problems that center around too much trash and not enough recyclables. Jeanette Romano and Kira Hagerman came on Regionally Speaking not long ago to talk about what is supposed to go out for recycling and what cannot be accepted. Well, first, we hear from Jeanette.
What residents are doing is wishful recycling. If they find something that's plastic, they're recycling it. It might not be something that's recyclable. If they're putting trash into their recycling container, well, now they're getting trash getting sent to other countries. And, mm-hmm. and that's what's caused the problem. China got a lot of trash sent to them. And so their environmental department is trying to clean up their country.
I know the major problems here in Lake County of recent months, in fact, even as recently as this month, have turned out to be in a brand new drop-off center that was set up here in Lake County. Only been open, about three years, I guess, when it was finally had the grand opening, so to speak. But now it's had to close up. Tell us the problems that have happened with the Lake County Government Center and how it all seems to fit together with the overall problem we have in trying to do the right thing to recycle, to save the planet, the other things that we always talk about, but also, too, to be able to provide responsible materials that can go off and be reused.
Well, Chris, that is the third center that the district has placed in the city of Crown Point. And we thought placing it there at the government center would be a deterrent from illegal dumping. And it started out very well. But the past year, year and a half, I would say, it has just escalated. We went from a three-day collection there at that center to a five-day collection. And not only did our contractor waste management have a team go out 2 days a week to maintain the site, but we learned that the government center had a team that cleaned up the site every day, especially on Mondays after a heavy illegal dumping. A very nice lady called me yesterday and asked where the center went. She wasn't upset, but she said she went there one day. There was a mattress there. She took a piece of paper and she wrote on it, "This is the kind of things that will end this center for us." And she said she had been there one time where there were four loads. She said it looked like somebody had just dumped four truckloads of material. And she said she felt sorry for whoever had to clean that up because that she said it never made it in the containers. It was just dumped on the ground. It's not good fiscal use of taxpayer dollars to keep paying for cleaning up and landfilling when it's supposed to be meant for recycling.
Well, in fact, I was going to ask you next, what is the financial ramifications of this? Because if the material was clean and was well sorted in the containers where they were supposed to go, at least that the waste management trucks could come by and pick up the containers and take the material off to be processed and reused again, hopefully. But here you've got this big, massive trash, basically. So you say that it all ends up getting scooped up and it ends up going into a trash truck, and then it ends up going to the landfill, which is outside of Lake County.
And when we do have the illegal dumping there and waste management has to send a separate truck, they do bill us for that. And over the last year and a half, we've been analyzing every month how much of our costs go to actual recycling and how much of the cost is due to contamination and overage. And we got to about 30% that was a contamination and overage cost of our total bill. 30% of it was contamination.
Now, how does this problem that's cropped up with this new center, again, another one set up in Crown Point, how does this compare to some of the other drop-off centers that you have set up in other locations around the county?
Seems like a lot of it was cyclical. And one would get better for a while, and then it would go downhill, and we would maybe place new bins one place to try to help. And that would be good for a while, but then it would go downhill again. So we had anywhere from probably 5% contamination up to 35% contamination at the other locations around the county.
Now, I know in the letter that you got from the Lake County Commissioners explaining the situation, which I'm sure you were very much aware of course, but the making it more official, their request that the drop-off center be closed, the containers removed, and the area cleaned up. I guess they were very nice. They thanked you for the efforts to bring more recycling options to Lake County. What's the next step going to be, or can there be a next step, I suppose?
We're thinking about that. You know, recycling is right, and it is a good thing to do. And we do need to reduce our waste going to the landfills. That is our mission. And so we're going to be thinking about this, Chris. We don't know what the best option is. It certainly is not an unmanned drop-off center, because you're going to get those people to come in there and illegally dump their mattresses, their construction material, their couches, their TVs, their computers, all their items because they're moving, their paint, their tires. There are places that the district has throughout the county for those types of materials. And we are trying to also keep the public educated on how to properly recycle those materials and where to take them. The drop-off centers were not the places to take them.
If you have the situation where you've now lost another drop-off center, you're trying to figure out what the next option is going to be, what can we tell people as they're listening to our conversation as ways to be able to help deal with the situation of not only helping to recycle properly, but also deal with this trash load that's being dumped on the public?
Well, we do have a pretty extensive website where residents can go and learn where to recycle all sorts of materials. As Jeanette mentioned, we have resources for tires and electronics and where you can take your paint, but we also have all the little things where batteries can go.
Website address is www.lswmd.com. With another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Meg Roman, the Executive Director of the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District. Welcome back, Meg.
Thank you, John.
It's been a while since you've been here to visit.
A little while, yes. Yeah. So glad to be back.
You always have a lot going on.
We do.
I was so struck by the exhibit I saw recently of, say the artist's name,
Carmelo Saracino, Evidence of Time Spent.
I just love that exhibit.
Yes, it's a really interesting one.
And so now you have all kinds of summer stuff coming up.
This is a big
time for the beach community of Miller.
Yeah, we're super busy this summer.
What's going on?
Well, we, amongst our normal art exhibits and occasional other things, we're launching a couple new things this summer that all mostly came out of the Arts on the Table initiative that the Regional Arts Council did, umbrellaed by South Shore Arts. Mm-hmm. So we did some community discussions and asked people what they wanted, and now we're going to give it to them.
Well, that I haven't given anybody anything they've wanted at my Arts on the Table events, not because I'm unwilling, but what struck you that you were inspired to?
Well, the number one thing people said they wanted, down to the person, was live music on a regular basis.
Wow.
So we have done concerts here and there. We also have live music at our farmers market, but we wanted to do something that people could rely on. So we're launching Live on Lake Street, which will be live music every third Thursday, starting at 6 p.m.
Got it.
So the price will vary and the band will vary, but it will always be the third Thursday.
So are you paying these artists to perform?
We are indeed. And we're getting sponsorships, and most of our exhibits and events are free, but for this we will be charging at the door.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you might have hit on something.
Yep. Well, people are tired of going back into Chicago for something to do. So we want to bring something that people are interested in, that they can rely on. And then we're hoping it will build from there.
I think it will. And I might add that my exhibit, Haunts, is up throughout the month of June.
It is indeed. We love it. We love that you've shared it with us. It's the second one in the series.
Yes, the Urban Legends series.
Yes, and our friends DK Devils and all kinds of other urban explorers are up on the walls, so it's
the photography of urban ruins.
Indeed.
And what might be done about that, or what could come out of that?
So hopefully some good ideas about how to treat our architecture and our unused buildings in a different way.
So what else do you have coming up this summer, Meg?
Well, we are doing a comedy show on June 15th, and that will be with live music starting the show, and then two comedians, Marty DeRosa and Kristen Toomey. Tickets for that show are $30. And there's a limited number of VIP tickets at $50, which will give you a front seat and a couple goodies. And it's being produced by David Gearman from the production company Comedy in the Region. So he came to us and asked if he could help us out, and we said, yes, we would love your help, and who doesn't like a good comedian?
Yeah, you know, that's the Art Center, where I'm located in Munster, has been doing quite well with comedy nights since the Star Plaza Theater closed.
Indeed, that's true.
Yeah, I didn't know that that was such a big thing at the Star Plaza, but they've been picking up on it at the Art Center, and they've been very successful with it, apparently, so that's good.
Great. Well, we're always trying to bring something new and different, and you know, bring more people in and appeal to as many people as we can. So,
and you know, the breadth of, or the geographical breadth of Northwest Indiana is such that people will go nearby, and where it's closest and most convenient for them, and where they feel most comfortable.
Right.
To be.
And there's plenty of opportunity in Northwest Indiana.
And then you have your farmers market every weekend.
We do. Our farmers market opened June 2nd, and it is every Sunday through August, mm-hmm. from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Mm-hmm. There's always, in addition to organic produce, there's arts and arts vendors, jewelry vendors, and also there's something fun to do every week. We do yoga sometimes. There's a putt-putt golf course. We always have live music. So it's on the corner of Lake Street and Route 12. Right by the old Miller School. You can, sometimes the train drivers from the South Shore will wave to us.
Do they toot?
They do, and they sometimes stop and come and get food from the food vendors. So.
Wow, that's an endorsement.
There's always something for everything.
So film and live music and comedy are all coming to the Marshall J. Gardner Center at the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District this summer. Well, Meg, thank you for being here to tell us about all of those wonderful things.
You're very welcome.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You can hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. And tune in again next Monday here at this time for another Eye on the Arts conversation on Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte, and we have a special program for you tomorrow. I'm back with you on Wednesday.